This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Lester Graham. On today's program, we talk about the opioid addiction crisis among veterans.
10 years ago, really the biggest risk factor for overdose or opioid overdose death was the receipt of prescription opioids, whereas now it's heroin and synthetic opioids.
And how one county plans to expand its morgue because of an increased number of opioid deaths.
We're at a point where our office cooler space is near the max capacity on any given day.
Then political campaign spending is going up, and Michigan will see a lot of political ads.
There will be a lot of TV stations that are going to be very happy with the amount of money coming into their buildings.
And we talk about a couple of decisions by the governor that's angered many African-American leaders.
Being an effective governor means you have to make difficult decisions on issues.
Plus, we'll talk with an expert about the census. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. More veterans are dying of opioid overdoses. Over a six-year period, the rate jumped 65%, and it's not just because of prescription pain pills.
A number of important factors are contributing, and probably the biggest one of all is really the changes in the supply of opioids on the street.
That's later in the hour. But first, the nation watched as the Trump administration argued for putting a citizenship question on the census form. The Supreme Court seemed to settle the issue. No citizenship question unless the government has a better reason than it's given so far. That's an oversimplification of what happened, and the issue really has not been settled. Joining us now is a former chair of the Census Bureau Scientific Advisory Committee. Barbara Anderson is a University of Michigan demographer, and she joins us now. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So let's start from the beginning. What is the purpose of the census?
The purpose of the census is to give a complete enumeration of the population. In the Constitution, the purpose of the census is put forth as doing a total count of residents, in order to be able to allocate seats in the House of Representatives.
Groups challenge the government's idea of putting the citizenship question on the form. It went to court to stop that being added to the census form. What was their concern?
Their concern was it would be mainly used to discourage people who were non-citizens or people who lived in households with non-citizens from responding. In addition, when the Justice Department and the Higher Commerce Department first asked the Census Bureau about this, John Aboud, who's their chief scientist, at the request of the Census Bureau, wrote an extended report proposing four alternative ways to get the information about citizenship, which would be cheaper and easier and work better than putting it on the census. And the top method that he suggested was to compile it from existing administrative data, which is what the Trump administration finally came to, I guess, today or yesterday.
And we'll get to that in a little bit. But
they
wanted
came right back to what the Census Bureau had recommended over a year ago.
Right. So while the courts were looking at whether the citizenship question should be asked, the daughter of a political strategist who had died released some of his papers indicating a citizenship question was designed to give Republicans an advantage in reapportionment and redistricting. How would that work?
Well, there's two aspects of it. One thing that I have become convinced of, and many other demographers I know are convinced of, that the main purpose behind trying to put a citizenship question on the census was actually not to repress response, that the main purpose was to lay the first step in the groundwork to try to change the basis of allocation of seats in the House of Representatives from all citizens to voting age, from all residents to voting age citizens. And in 2016, the demographer Andrew Beveridge estimated that such a change would result in a loss of 5 to 6 Democratic members of the House of Representatives. Many groups have in the past wanted to do this, but it's been commented many times that you can't do this if you don't have data, and the data really need to be from the census. The American Community Survey asks citizenship, but it's only asked of 2 or 3% of all households, and that doesn't cover everybody. And in the authorization for the American Community Survey, it explicitly says that American Community Survey results cannot be used for allocation of seats in the House of Representatives.
Now, as you mentioned, President Trump yesterday indicated his administration would gather the data they want on citizenship through other means, as was earlier recommended. Here's Attorney General William Barr.
That information will be used for countless purposes, as the president explained in his remarks today. For example, there is a current dispute over whether illegal aliens can be included for apportionment purposes. Depending on the resolution of that dispute, this data may be relevant to those considerations. We will be studying this issue.
What does that statement tell you?
Well, it tells me he probably doesn't know what he's talking about. That there is no suggestion that the data on citizens and non-citizens would in any way give you information about whether the non-citizens are in the United States legally or not.
You know, the president is accusing Democrats and others of trying to erase the very existence of citizenship in this country by insisting everyone be counted. What did you think of that statement?
Well, that the Constitution says everyone has to be counted.
But does that...
This isn't something that was dreamed up recently.
But does that denigrate somehow citizenship? I mean, I realize this is a political battle at this time, not a constitutional argument, but it seems like that would have a lot of impact on a lot of President Trump's base.
You mean they'd like it?
Exactly. It's exactly
well, I mean, President Trump says a variety of things sometimes that are shown to be not true. And I'm sure he says many things because he thinks his base will like it, and that's his prerogative. One thing that many people have been concerned about is that even with the citizenship question not on the census, that the publicity about it, and perhaps even after all this, and even after the administration said it's not going to be on the census, this doesn't mean that administration people won't keep on saying that it may be on, and this could be a tactic to suppress response.
Well, let me ask you this. Has the damage already been done by scaring non-citizens?
Well, that is one concern. But also, there are things that can be done and will be done to try to counter that. In the year 2000, in the months around the 2000 census, all immigration raids were called off in order to encourage participation in the census. In 2010, immigration raids were not called off around the time of the census. What was done, the Census Bureau recruited 250,000 community pardoners to try to encourage participation in the census. This is very important. To the most recent information I have, this time recruitment has been slow, I think partly because of these concerns. But when the community partners are convinced that citizenship will not be asked, there's a lot of concern with getting full counts in terms of allocation of funds to communities. And what I hope and expect will happen is that there will be a substantial upsurge in the enrollment of community partners for the 2020 census, which could at least to some extent mitigate whatever damage has already been done. Also, the Census Bureau in its planning for the 2020 census has taken up a number of innovations to try to make response to the 2020 census much, much easier. One thing they have done is every household is going to get a letter with an ID number on it for responding to the census. But the Census Bureau has developed a way for people to be able to respond by computer, by smartphone, without having that ID number, which they had to do a lot for this. So one thought is that these community meetings, there'd be a bank of computers at the front. They'd encourage people to step up and respond for their household, and they don't have to have their ID number. In the development of this, they did a lot to try to guard against double responses from the same household. But a lot of this stuff was implemented even before all this about citizenship, just to try to increase how easy it is for people to respond to the census. Another thing which is important to keep in mind is even with the best efforts of everybody, you are going to have some undercount. The over time, the undercount of the population has gone down. The undercount of the total population in 2010 was about zero, but that was because there was a slightly more than 2% undercount of the African-American population and about a 0.5% overcount of the non-African-American population. That was totally due to overcount of females, and people think this is related to, is a result of people with two homes getting overcounted, at being counted at both places.
Mm-hmm.
And the census is doing a lot also to try to eliminate that. But they have progressively made progress in decreasing the undercount. So what people are talking about is not there being no undercount, but rather they're talking about not having, because of the citizenship question, an enormous, enormous increase in the undercount, especially of Hispanic and African-American population.
So let me ask you the final quick question. What's the takeaway for all of this, for the census and for political representation and resources going to urban areas?
Well, for urban areas, certainly it's better to respond than not to respond, because so much money is allocated based on it. In 1980 and 1990, the city of Detroit sued the census because of the well-known undercount of minority ethnic groups, and they wanted to be able to use statistical estimation to adjust the census count. Detroit lost both of those suits, and they said it has to be a real count or something like a neighbor can we report on the residents in a neighboring dwelling unit without people actually having to talk to them. But one reason why the Supreme Court rejected Detroit's suit is that although it could be well shown that statistical estimation adjustment of a census would improve the count of almost all places, it could not show that there would not be some places where the count would be made worse by that. And that was part of the reason the Supreme Court rejected the found against the city of Detroit.
Barbara Anderson is a University of Michigan demographer and a former chair of the Census Bureau's Scientific Advisory Committee. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
We've got more to come. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. An increasing number of veterans are dying of opioid overdoses. Between 2000 and 2016, the rate jumped 65%. And most of those veterans had not gotten a prescription for an opioid filled in the last 3 months of their life. Here to help us better understand what's going on is Allison Lynn. She's an addiction psychiatrist at the VA in Ann Arbor. Thanks for joining us. So what's behind these growing numbers of veteran overdose deaths?
That's a really important question that a number of us are trying to investigate. And we don't have the clear answers to that just yet. I think in reality, a number of important factors are contributing. And probably the biggest one of all is really the changes in the supply of opioids on the street. So what we found in our study is that specifically what accounts for the increase in opioid overdose deaths are really the increases in deaths related to heroin and synthetic opioids, which are these days mostly the street opioids.
Right. And it's, you know, everyone has heard, anybody who's listened to the news or knows about this, taking heroin and the risk of it being laced with fentanyl is pretty well known. Why are people still taking that risk?
So that is really the question that underlies the illness of addiction, right? As an addiction psychiatrist, I work with a lot of patients, veterans currently, with opioid and other addictions. And by the nature of the illness, right, by the definition of what an addiction is, it's the ongoing use or the inability to stop using despite multiple negative consequences. So if someone didn't actually have a trouble stopping, they wouldn't have the underlying illness itself.
Are most of these vets, were they once under prescription for opioids and then switched to the street drugs?
So that's also a really good question. What we looked at specifically in our study was really just the overall changes in the trends. What we do know that from both national data outside of the VA and within the VA is that the overall trends have changed dramatically, right? So 10 years ago, really the biggest risk factor for overdose or opioid overdose death was the receipt of prescription opioids, whereas now it's heroin and synthetic opioids. We don't know the exact nature of what caused some of these shifts in trends, but we're still investigating those things. I think, like I said, probably a number of things contribute to that. The biggest one in my mind, to your particular question, is really if we've exposed a lot of people in this country to prescription opioids, a small proportion of them have a predilection for developing an addiction. And those are the folks who are probably most likely to go on and develop an addiction to heroin and other synthetic opioids.
I was reading in the research that the addiction rate in Michigan is higher than the national average. Does the medical community understand why that is the case?
I don't think we know exactly why. There's probably a number of factors again. You know, we know some of the main factors for addiction, right? They have to do with things along socio-demographic factors, but also really a lot of the other major risk factors for addiction.
What do you mean by socioeconomic factors? How does that play into it?
So, for example, and this is different across different addictions. So opioid different from alcohol and other substance use disorders. But we do know that certain subgroups of people have a higher risk for addiction. But more important than that, I would say, and what I think accounts for a lot of the opioid addiction that we see now, is really a population who have a lot of these factors together. So folks who have both addiction to opioids, addiction to other substances like cocaine and alcohol, and also multiple mental health disorders alongside chronic pain. And that's really the challenge that we're faced with addressing.
Well, and it is a big challenge. What can Veterans Affairs do for vets who are at risk of an opioid overdose?
So that's a really good question. And that's one thing that we try to make a first step on, at least with the current trends that we see. So the specific major implication of this paper or this recent study is that because the vast majority of veterans who are dying from overdoses are no longer actively receiving prescription opioids, we really have to broaden our sense, broaden our perspectives around screening and things like that beyond those actively receiving prescription opioids. The VA has traditionally been, you know, an early adopter, a leader in delivering addiction treatment. It's probably the largest provider of addiction treatment as a whole in the country. And so it's really made a huge emphasis in the past in increasing access to medication treatment for people with opioid use disorders. And we've seen increased uptake, but there are still huge gaps in different parts of the country.
You've been running a pilot program of telemedicine for people dependent on opioids at VA clinics in the state. How do patients respond to care from a provider by video conference?
Yeah, that's really a really cool thing, I would say. So currently we have some research and work underway, both within the state of Michigan and also in the VA, have a research study where we're trying to really take a comprehensive look at how we develop a successful model of telemedicine treatment that people are going to be able to use, find it usable, and also that they can relate to their providers, and one that's also can be implemented across different facilities. I can say that for some of the folks I've worked with, meaning me sitting here and seeing them via a video screen and talking to them through a monitor rather than in person, in many ways, it's not so different. I think the key parts of any relationship between a provider and a patient is really the ongoing relationship, the caring nature of the relationship, the openness in both parties. And I think through with a lot of that, we basically are able to maintain the same connection. We've shown through decades of research for other chronic medical conditions like depression and other similar disorders that people do almost just as well or probably just as well with telemedicine delivered treatment, but we just haven't studied it for addiction.
What do you still need to know about telemedicine for treating patients with addictions?
Well, I think there's a lot of questions because this is a very early area and a number of people are looking at it. I think some of the basic questions are, does it work as well, right? Does it work? Will people use it? Do we have the infrastructure to be able to implement it? Because, the aspect that's unique to addiction, that a lot of addiction care has taken place outside of traditional medical environments. Can we engage people into treatment? That's actually a huge question right now, is even if we make the treatment available, will people be able to engage or be interested? Because that's part of the nature of the addiction itself.
Right. And, it seems like you have to rely on surrogates to encourage somebody. You can't get in contact with them. That makes it a little more difficult as well, right?
That's a similar issue that we have with in-person treatment, right? Mm. For example, most of the folks who come and see me, they do it through referrals or they know to contact our clinic and such. So it's a similar problem as we would have in telemedicine. But what you're referring to is are the people in the person's life, the patient's life, who might be able to help get them engaged into treatment, both to make them aware, but really the bigger step is how do you really help motivate someone to overcome, you know, the illness that they have that tells them to keep using in order to stop using and engage in treatment.
It'll be really interesting to see how your telemedicine pilot program goes and find out whether it actually is helpful. I imagine for a lot of the remote offices around the state, that would be incredibly helpful. Dr. Allison Lin is an addiction psychiatrist at the VA in Ann Arbor. She's been running a pilot program using telemedicine to help vets addicted to opioid at VA clinics in Michigan. Thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you.
Macomb County is considering adding $2 million for additional staff and building expansion at the county morgue to handle an increasing number of deaths. And here to talk about why each year there are a lot more deaths than there were just a few years ago is the Macomb County Medical Examiner, Dr. Daniel Spitz. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So the Macomb Daily reported in 2017, there was a 52% increase in deaths over the numbers back in 2011. Help us understand why. I know there are a lot of reasons. Let's take them one at a time, like the population of Macomb County has been growing, right?
Well, the population has been growing, and certainly the population is aging. And so those two reasons account for a greater number of deaths.
Right. We've got the big baby boom population getting up there in years.
Well, that's true. And I think one of the major reasons is really just the opiate epidemic, which everybody has heard about. Macomb County is certainly right in the middle of this. And because of that, quite a tremendous increase in the number of drug overdoses over the last few years. And opiates seem to be the biggest culprit.
What kind of numbers are you seeing? I mean, give us an idea of the increase.
Well, I think, you know, we're really having in the range of one or so drug overdose a day in the county. Of course, it doesn't happen that way. Sometimes one might have four or five in one day and then have a few days without any. But at the end of the day, you know, we're around one per day, which is really a staggering number when you think these are really senseless type deaths.
Now, of course, we didn't mention suicides, but that's always a constant, it seems like. You take all those numbers together, how many deaths are you examining in a year?
Well, the office is investigating over 3,000 deaths per year, and of those, in the range of 750 or so come into the office for some type of an exam. You know, that's certainly more than double what it was when I first started in 2004, and double-digit increase percentage-wise since we built the current building that we're in 2007.
How many medical examiners do you have doing that work?
Well, currently we have two.
Two?
That's correct. And we are utilizing, we do have some resources to utilize some additional board-certified forensic pathologists who do what we call locum tenens type work. These are forensic pathologists from neighboring counties who come and do some cases to help keep the workload at a manageable level.
So this $2 million that the county executive, Mark Hackle, is talking about would be for staff, and I understand a building expansion. Why do you need a building expansion?
Well, as the number of cases increases, you know, various processes are stressed. One is staffing. So we've you know, we're allotting some money for additional forensic investigators. We're thinking about utilizing some of that money that we've put toward the locum tenens type pathology work to actually have another full-time forensic pathologist in the near future. And with more people comes a need for more office space. And so we're looking to increase our office space for the investigators to work, some office space for our record keeping, and additional cooler space so that we can, you know, manage the increasing numbers of cases that are coming into the office. Part of the expansion also addresses a need for just tighter security in and around the building. And so we're addressing that as well, and certainly that's adding to the cost.
Not to be coarse about this, but you're talking about the need for space for more bodies on ice, basically.
Well, our cooler space will increase significantly so that, yes, we have more people coming into the office. Keep in mind that, you know, when a decedent comes in and an exam is done, the body doesn't leave the building immediately. So, you know, sometimes it's 2-3 days before families make arrangements and funeral homes are contacted. So we need to have space in order to allow for this. And currently we're at a point where our office cooler space is near the max capacity on any given day.
I only have one more quick question. How does Macomb County's need for expansion of staff and building reflect the situation in the rest of the state?
Well, there's no question that the opiate epidemic is affecting, really all counties. You know, I also work in St. Clair County, and certainly there's some preliminary talks of an expansion in that county. And so, you know, I'm well aware of what's going on in Macomb and St. Clair County, but I'm also peripherally aware of what's going on in other neighboring counties, and certainly those counties are pinched as well.
Dr. Daniel Spitz is the Macomb County Medical Examiner. Thanks for the time. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Here's something that happened. Several people showed up at the Detroit Police Commission meeting last night. They wanted to voice their disapproval about a proposal to use facial recognition cameras. So it's the police commissioners and several police officers at the meeting. And before the meeting was over, the police were handcuffing and arresting one of the commissioners. Here to talk about what happened is George Hunter, crime reporter for the Detroit News. You were there last night, right?
I was.
And let's kind of break down what happened. Commissioner Willie Burton kind of interrupted the process because he wanted to talk at length about facial recognition cameras. What happened from there?
Well, this has sort of been brewing for months now. There have been sniping back and forth almost every meeting between Mr. Burton and other members. Burton says that they're trying to, silence him. He's had a myriad issues that he's brought up. He's concerned about, subcommittees meeting. He says that they're violating the Open Meetings Act. That was the first real, argument that they were having a couple months ago. And then almost every meeting now, it's devolved into some yelling back and forth. And last night it all came to a head. I couldn't believe what I was seeing. They said they're going to have, they gave him warnings. They said, you're out of order. You're out of order, Lisa Carter, the new board chair. And at some point she finally said, hey, can we have him removed? And they did. They walked up behind him and sort of put, they were trying to gently do it, and he like raised his hands and he kind of fell backwards onto the floor. It was, and meanwhile, the people in the meeting were rushing up to the front of the room, and then the cops sort of formed a cordon around the officers who were trying to cuff the commissioner, and it didn't get physical or anything, but they were kind of holding people back, telling them with their hands sort of, come on, get back kind of thing. It was nuts.
Still, having the Detroit police remove, handcuff, and arrest a Detroit police commissioner is a really interesting situation. What did Commissioner Burton have to say about it?
Well, I just talked to him about 10 minutes ago. He says he's getting inundated with calls, as you might imagine. And his quote was that they're shutting down democracy. That's his exact quote. I asked him, because to the other people's point is that he's out of order and he's disrupting the meetings, and they're saying we can't have that. We can't conduct meetings if somebody won't follow the rules of discourse. One of the interesting things too there, Lester, is I asked him what the jail was like, and he says, wow, it was an inhumane experience. Jail is not pretty. That was the quote he gave me. And, there's nothing nice when you're in handcuffs. I was carried out of a police board of commissioner meeting and thrown onto the floor in the district that I represent, which is in the 10th precinct. And I think that he's saying that's why the people were so angry. And a lot of the people during the public comment portion of the of the meeting did express, you know, outrage that this happened. And again, I talked to the other commissioners. I talked to, you know, others who were there, and they're like, their contention is that you can't have somebody just interrupting meetings and talking. You know, I'll leave it up to, you know, I'll leave it up. It's not my purview to decide whether it's right or wrong.
Really violated, you know, Robert's rules of orders or not.
I just write it all down and try to spell their names right, you know, so I don't make moral judgments on this. But certainly there are those who say the board was justified in what they did, and there are a lot of people also saying that they're outraged by what happened and they feel like this is, you know, that they're shutting down a voice.
George Hunter is a reporter for the Detroit News covering the crime beat. Hey, thanks for taking a moment to tell us what happened.
Anytime. Thank you. Have a nice day.
Still to come, the Democratic presidential candidates are coming to Michigan for debates later this month. If you're wondering just how much money will be spent on political ads in our state, you're not the only one.
Money is having a bigger effect, and money is a crucial part of the story of how our government is operating right now.
The executive director of the Michigan Campaign Finance Network gives us a political advertising forecast after the break. You're listening to Stateside on Michigan Radio. Stick around. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Some of the people who backed Gretchen Whitmer for governor are now not happy with her because of a couple of recent moves. One is her support to changes in the no-fault auto insurance law, which has led to more questions than answers. And the second is the handling of the Benton Harbor High School, where school board officials say there was no agreement with state, and state officials say there was an agreement on whether to keep the high school open. Joining us to talk about what that means for the governor and trust in the administration is Vicki Barnett, the former mayor of Farmington Hills and a former Democratic legislator, and Ken Sikkema, senior policy fellow at Public Sector Consultants and former Republican legislative leader. So, Vicki, some of the African-American legislators questioned the no-fault deal, the auto no-fault deal. Some calculations show Detroiters, who pay the highest rates in the nation, will see very little or no reductions in insurance premiums, and they're critical of the governor because of her support of these changes. Has she lost trust among some of her constituents?
I don't think she's lost trust. There are some of us that are not happy with that particular piece of legislation, knowing full well that it wasn't going to accomplish what many people with high rates had hoped it would accomplish. So there is disappointment. Personally, I'm a little disappointed that there wasn't a road funding deal tossed in exchange. So I think that we're still looking at some problems down the road in terms of how the governor is going to satisfy her base and fix the roads and find the money to do that. And the fact that she's given up an awful lot in terms of the auto no-fault deal is problematic.
So is it going to cause problems for her within her constituency, within her base, or is it going to be paid off because she'll have more cooperation from the Republican legislature?
I think that it is going to affect her base a little bit, but don't forget, she's the only Democrat serving in the legislative branch is the executive, but she's dealing with a Republican House and a Republican Senate, and so there has to be some compromise along the way. This is a learning curve for everybody in the legislature right now, both the Republicans and the Democrats, learning how to deal with a Democratic executive and a Republican legislative branch. So she's giving it her best shot, and they're starting to work together, the Republicans and the Democrats, which is always a good thing, and I am hopeful for the future.
Ken Sikkema, there are more questions than answers, like I said, when it comes to what we all will pay for auto insurance in the future. Is this deal to overhaul no fault going to do more harm than good for Whitmer?
Well, I just think it's too early to speculate on what the political impact is going to be on any issue 3 years from now when she's running for re-election. You know, that's a long, long time in politics. Now, on auto insurance, you know, it doesn't, the rate cuts don't take effect until a year from now. Now, if 3 years from now, which means 2022, if people in Michigan are still saying, hey, auto insurance is too high, then, Yeah, so then I think it's a problem for her and probably for anybody running for re-election. But I just think 3 years ahead of an election is just way too early to speculate on what the political impact is going to be.
Yeah, Ken, I guess I wasn't really trying to imply this might have an impact on re-election, but does disappointing some of the people who support you have implications in getting things done in this term?
Well, being an effective governor means you have to make difficult decisions on issues. And not everybody, including people, you know, your political supporters, are going to be happy about every decision. And I actually give the governor credit for being willing to make some tough decisions. You know, she's doing that, and that's what good, effective governors have to do.
Vicky, the other issue that has a lot of African Americans in particular upset is this disagreement about whether there was an agreement on the path forward for Benton Harbor High School. So, Vicky, again, this has African American legislators, leaders, some progressives, many of whom voted for Gretchen Whitmer, angry with the governor. Does she have to repair trust among this important part of her voter base?
This is a big issue when we're dealing with education across the state, and we're dealing with minority communities who have felt left behind in terms of funding for their schools, and actually have had some severe problems with education, and yet they're the only school districts that ended up with financial managers and been threatened with dissolution, despite the fact that predominantly white school districts have not been so threatened. I think this is an attempt of the governor to try to repair something. I believe each side thought what they thought. I think the governor genuinely thought they had a deal. I think that the school board of Benton Harbor genuinely thought they did not have a deal, and we'll see how that plays out. But Ken's right. You know, 3 years is 3.5 years is a long time from now, and we know we have problems in education across the state. We rank last in the nation in terms of funding our public schools. That's got to be fixed. The governor has said it needs to be fixed, and now the legislature has to step up to the plate and find the revenue necessary to not only fix the schools but fix the roads.
So, Ken, when you've got African-American voters on the west side of the state, African-American voters in Detroit, both aggravated at the governor. And during the campaigns, there were a number of complaints about she wasn't visiting their neighborhoods. She wasn't, she was taking the African-American vote for granted. That seems like there's increased animosity toward the governor from a group that I think a lot of Democrats expect a lot of support from. What's your make of all that?
Well, Lester, I'm not sure I'm the best person to, you know, being able to analyze the feelings of the African-American community toward Governor Whitmer.
But you and me both. It's two white guys who, I understand what you're saying.
I mean, I'm a white guy from West Michigan. That's why I say I'm not sure I'm the best person to make that analysis. But let me just say this. Generally, political alienation doesn't occur because of one issue or one event or one incident or one dust-up. I mean, it has to occur. Real political alienation occurs over time because of many, many issues. And, you know, I just go back to, I think, 3 years ahead of an election in terms of what ultimately the impact is just a little too early.
Well, I hate to wrap it up on a sad note, but Vicky, I was looking back. My records show you've been a Michigan radio political commentator since the beginning of 2017, and I'm sorry to say this is our last chat because you're going to be a candidate for office.
Yes, I am. I'm running for mayor of Farmington Hills.
Well, it's been a real pleasure talking to you over the last couple of years, and I tell you, I'm always impressed about how well you research the issues, and I want to thank you for that.
Thank you. It's been a real joy being able to look at issues and analyze them for citizens has just been a thrill, especially with this team that you've assembled at stateside. So I wish you all the best in the future. And it's been fun.
And of course, Ken, we'll talk to you next week.
Well, I've really enjoyed being on with Vicky, and I wish her the best, but also kind of sad that she can't join us every week.
Well, I really enjoyed working with you too, Ken. And, your loss to our legislature has been one of the sad victims of term limits.
Hmm. All right, you two. Have a great weekend. Thanks again.
Okay.
You too.
Political ads for the presidential election in 2020 are starting now, nearly a year and a half before Election Day. Advertising on TV and digital platforms is expected to cost $6 billion, according to Advertising Analytics, which tracks political ads. Joining us now to talk about how this affects Michigan is Craig Mauger. He's the executive director of the Michigan Campaign Finance Network. That's a watchdog group which follows politics and money in Michigan. Hey, welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me, Lester.
So let's start with those presidential political ads we all love so much. The first salvo hit cable TV and digital outlets today. Who's advertising already?
Well, we have a lot of candidates who are advertising on social media right now. I mean, a lot of the Democratic candidates are advertising on Facebook to try to raise money in order to qualify for upcoming Democratic debates. That's been going on for a while. President Trump's campaign has been spending millions of dollars on Facebook advertising. When it comes to TV advertising, the word is that one of the Democratic presidential candidates, Kirsten Gillibrand, is going to start running some cable ads here soon. So, you know, we're pretty far out from the election, and the TV advertising and digital advertising has already got some rocket fuel behind it.
Yeah, I was reading a post by Jonathan Oesting, I should say, an article by Oesting, who he's saying that Gillibrand's going to be going through a few states in the Midwest with something called a Trump Broken Promises Tour. Is this kind of standard to throw out some TV spots just because you're running through a few states? Does that make sense?
I think that we're at a place with these presidential campaigns where they're posting huge fundraising numbers. I mean, they're raising millions upon millions of dollars this far out. And if you're trying to get your poll numbers up, trying to become one of the top tier candidates, TV advertising and digital advertising are the best ways to raise your name ID. So for someone like her, at this point, running some TV ads is a way to get more people to know about you. And I think for there being, you know, more than 20 Democratic candidates for president, a lot of them are in this struggle for recognition.
Yeah, two dozen people running for the nomination. I want to ask you just one more question about timing of all this stuff. We'll get back to money in just a second. But, you know, there have already been several debates. Have we ever seen a race for president start so early?
That's a great question. I mean, it seems like each cycle elections are starting earlier and earlier. I haven't looked at exactly the presidential election start dates, but I know before when I've looked at U.S. House campaigns, they're starting earlier and earlier. I mean, when you look at how much money these candidates have to raise, the earlier you start, the bigger jump you get on raising that money.
Well, let's talk about the money that's being spent. As I mentioned at the beginning, $6 billion overall in the nation on presidential campaign. Advertising Analytics predicts broadcast and cable TV will get about $4.4 billion of that $6 billion nationwide. If Michigan is considered a swing state, what's that going to mean for TV in this state?
It will mean that there will be a lot of TV stations that are going to be very happy with the amount of money coming into their buildings later this year. I mean, if Michigan is one of five swing states that are going to decide this election, and that's what people expect right now. Expectations in politics can be very wrong, and they're wrong very often, but we will see millions upon millions of dollars in TV advertising. I was looking back at 2016, where a lot of people thought going into the year that Michigan was going to be in Hillary Clinton's hands and that the Clinton campaign wasn't going to have to spend a lot of money to win the state. There were only about, I think, 3 million or so ads broadcast and spending on broadcast TV ads in Michigan before the 2016 election. And a lot of it happened right before the election in the final couple of weeks. If Michigan is on both campaigns' radar going in from the beginning, you know, we'll see sustained advertising from the candidates and of course, these outside spender super PACs for months leading up to the election. So we'll see a huge jump in advertising likely over what we saw in 2016. Money follows competition. So if it's close in Michigan, it's going to cost a lot.
Yeah, this Advertising Analytics I was talking about, they predict that there's $121 million coming to Michigan for both cable and broadcast TV. Does that seem possible?
I mean, it's very possible. I mean, I think that number is very possible. It could be more than that. I mean, there's already been, I think Michigan is already in the top 10 states as it stands right now for Facebook political ads. When I checked this morning, I counted four campaigns that have spent already more than $1 million on Facebook ads across the country. The money is flowing, and these candidates are raising very large sums.
There's a couple of new platforms where the parties are bringing in money. Act Blue for the Democrats and Win Red for the Republicans. What role are they playing in the overall effort to raise money for political campaigns?
They play a huge role. Act Blue specifically has played a very large role for a while on the Democratic side that has allowed Democratic candidates to kind of use their platform and use their abilities to grow the number of grassroots donors to their campaign. So if you're a candidate in Michigan, Act Blue has really provided a way for you to raise money pretty effectively from donors across the country who are interested in supporting Democratic candidates across the country. The Republicans have not had a platform that has had the same type of success as Act Blue, but now going into 2020, I think the Republicans think that they've got some ideas for how to match that.
And so Win Red's the new kid on the block, and they're hoping it will do something as well as Act Blue.
That's what they're hoping, and we'll see how that plays out. There have been other hopes before that haven't really matched Act Blue.
We often talk about dark money, the cash that's funneled to campaigns for or against candidates, but who's giving that money remains secret. What kind of role do you expect dark money to play in the 2020 campaign compared to 2018 or 2016?
Yeah, I mean, I think dark money is always going to be something that's growing in our elections until, you know, there's legislative action to rein it in or to shed light on who these donors are. There are donors out there, large donors, that would rather give without their names attached to it. That's what dark money is. It's anonymous spending in our political elections, and it's been something that's growing. Where you really see the growth, however, is in this something called outside spending, super PAC spending, independent spending, however you want to classify it for people watching it. This is spending that's done outside of the candidate's campaign. So we talk about in the media all the time, here's how much this candidate raised and here's how much that candidate raised. That's really kind of the candidate showing their strength. A lot of the money in politics today comes through these independent groups that act outside of the candidates' campaigns. They can accept unlimited contributions. They can often take dark money as well that can't be traced back to a donor. The candidates have limits on how much they can raise, and their donors have to be disclosed to the public. So you've had this shift in recent years away from the candidate money and to this unlimited outside money that's independent of the candidates, supposedly. And that's a shift that we're going to continue to see. I try not to throw out a ton of numbers, but here are two numbers. The 8th district race for the U.S. House in 2018 was the most expensive U.S. House race Michigan's ever seen. Alyssa Slotkin and Mike Bishop. That race drew about $28 million. $17 million of that $28 million came from groups acting outside of the Bishop and Slotkin campaign. That's the wide majority of it.
Sometimes it sounds like that's the hand on the chessboard, and the politicians end up being just pieces on the board. It's really kind of scary to see because we don't know where those influences come from.
No, and sometimes we don't know, and sometimes we do. And a lot of times when we're able to figure out where the money's coming from, and especially these races for the U.S. House, it's being driven by, you know, a dozen or so very large donors who are interested in shifting the chessboard nationally. That was really a smart comment that you make about this being a chessboard. There are donors who want to see Democrats win the U.S. House. There are donors that want to see Republicans win the U.S. House, and they're investing in races to try to shift this chessboard, and it leads to some very expensive races across this country. And it's not all of the races are expensive. There's a chosen few where there is a ton of money. My mailbox in the 8th District in 2018 was seeing mailer after mailer after mailer. Someone's experience in another district in Michigan, like the 4th District or somewhere else, would be totally different.
I got to ask you, with these endless campaigns, because that's what they've become now, do you ever get a break? I mean, sounds like you're just gathering numbers all the time.
Yeah, I mean, we are gathering, we're trying to gather numbers all the time. And as people continue to fundraise more and more, it's something that we have to continue to do. I mean, there are breaks. I think I've had some time over the last months to do some other things than following the TV ad spending. But right now, this is what we've got to follow. I mean, because there's going to be a tremendous amount of spending here. Tracking where it's coming from and how much different candidates are spending and what groups are connected to them is kind of an essential part of democracy right now. Money is having a bigger effect, and money is a crucial part of the story of how our government is operating right now.
Craig Marger is with the Michigan Campaign Finance Network. He keeps track of money raised and money spent on politics in Michigan. Craig, thanks very much.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Lester Graham. Have a great weekend.